مت سوتی ہے. She lost her place at Tole National Assembly.
Luella Landers, National Assembly.
Namunde Khasmeni, NCOP.
Sheta Mufukeng, NCOP.
Let's continue.
Nick Warren of National Assembly.
Mfanelo Zamisa, Law Society of South Africa.
Let us proceed with the interested parties. Please introduce yourself.
I'm Paul Hoffman, and contrary to popular belief, I'm just a director of the Institute for Accountability in Southern Africa.
I'm Nikita Haviland, and I'm director of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Now we go to the Department of Justice representatives.
Yeah, thanks. Good morning. My name is Dion Radman, Deputy Director General, responsible for legislation in the Department of Justice.
I'm Jacob Scotland, Deputy Chief State Law Advisor, responsible for policy in the department.
If the media is here, he is J.B. Scosana, and not J.B. Sivanyoni, as it was reported yesterday on TV. I found calls from people. They asked me, how did you change and look differently? Like, we knew you differently before. Can we also give an opportunity to any other interested persons who are here just to introduce yourself?
I'm Steve Karnowitz from the Legal Resources Center.
I'm Yana Van Lee from the Legal Resources Center.
I'm Gwen Deremaker from the Democratic Rights and Governance Unit.
Shireen Mukadam from the Institute for Security Studies.
I'm Christine Tilstone from Parliament.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Let me explain. You might have seen that when the ad hoc committee ran an advert, it advertised that it should be dealing with the code as well as the regulations. Why? It ran as the Code of the Judicial Conduct and the Regulations on Judges' Registrable Interest initially, because as a matter of fact, this is the mandate of this ad hoc committee, this joint multi-party ad hoc committee. And when you look at the Judicial Service Commission Act, it says that the code and the regulation is drafted by the Chief Justice in consultation with the Minister of Justice. Now, what has happened is that after the code and the regulations were formally tabled in Parliament, there were some developments, because there was a meeting of the heads of court, and they submitted a draft. Now, that draft was submitted after the Minister had already tabled the code and the regulations. It necessitated the Minister looking at the draft and applying his mind. Now, there has been a request that this committee should rather only deal with the code of conduct and withhold the regulations until such time that the Minister applies his mind to the code. And then yesterday we did get a presentation from the Department of Justice. Because the media is here, I'll repeat. Mr. J.B. Scosana gave us the presentation. He is Scosana, not Sibanyundu. And then Today we will be having two, institutions here who are going to be making a presentation. Number one will be the Center for Constitutional Rights. It will be represented by Advocate N. de Havilland, and the Institute for Accountability in Southern Africa by Paul Hoffman, SC. But let me just mention that it doesn't mean at the end of the public hearings today the process is closed. If any person still wants to make a written submission, not a public hearing, an oral one, the door will still be kept open. Now, without any waste of time, I will call upon the Center for Constitutional Rights to do its presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Chairpersons, and thank you for the opportunity to make submissions. The Center's main mission is to uphold the Constitution, and foundational to upholding the Constitution is an independent judiciary. Insofar as the Code will ensure a standard of judicial conduct that promotes both the individual and the institutional independence of the judiciary, the Centre welcomes this move. Before detailing two specific concerns I have, and I was warned yesterday to contain my comments just to the Code, so I've left out my comments on the regulations, I just want to raise two general points, and the one I do with the greatest respect, and that is that I think arguably the discussion on the Code is premature, and that the peremptory author of the Code is the Chief Justice in consultation with the Minister. In contrast, the regulations in terms of 12.5 of the Empowering Act, which is the Judicial Service Commission Act, it is the Minister is the author after consultation with. But more importantly, in terms of the Act, consensus is contemplated between the Minister and the Chief Justice, but only in respect of the Code. So if there is no consensus in respect of the Code, the Act imposes a duty on the two versions being placed before the House. That duty is not in respect of regulations. The Centre understands that this Code, there was a draft submitted which was originally drawn up by the heads of court some time ago and endorsed by the Chief Justice, which was forwarded to the Minister. It contained provisions in respect of both the Code and the regulations. We've not seen that memorandum because it was a confidential document, but we have been led to believe that there are differences also in respect of the Code, not only just the regulation. So insofar as there may be differences, and I'm sure you will have sight of the memorandum in your deliberations, there is an obligation for Parliament to see where the areas where consensus is not reached in respect of the Code only. So that is my first general point, is on the nature of the authorship and the eventuality of there being no consensus. The other general point, and although it is also a substantive issue, but the only issue I'm going to talk to, which is retired judges, since both the Code and the regulations deal with retired judges, and by retired judges I mean specifically to the definition contained both in the Code, but more specifically in the Empowering Act, in the JSE Act, which refers to that unique category of either over 75, or who have performed 20 years of service or more, or have been discharged for whatever reason, normally it's ill health. That category, which is defined as retired judges, as opposed to the category who are discharged from active services, but have to make themselves available for 3 years to be called on to act again. That category of judges who have discharged are not retired judges. So when I refer to retired judges, I refer exclusively to the group of judges who have been removed from any obligation of performing any judicial function. And that is the category that I focus on. Obviously, it goes without saying that if there is a difference between what is said in the regulations governing judges discharged, and more specifically the retired judges, and the CURD, the two must correspond, which is why finalization of the CURD should perhaps only be done once the regulations have been finalized, or the two in conjunction, so that you don't have regulations and the CURD conflicting. The specific issue with retired judges, and before I do that, I just want to say how important the CURD is, because read in conjunction with the elucidatory notes, we have for the first time clarity, and more importantly, a legally enforceable framework in respect of standards of judicial behavior. Up until now, judges have been guided in their conduct by a 34-clause code issued by the Chief Justice in 2000, but this is not legally enforceable, and so no legally enforceable framework exists. And as a result, we have sorely lacked in getting legal clarity in interpretation. And I think this has evidenced itself in the most unfortunate recent behavior of certain judges, which brought the entire judiciary into disrepute because there was no framework of what behavior is acceptable and what is not acceptable. I do mention in my written submissions about a number of typographical and what I call drafting errors. I'm not going to waste this committee's time. I have also just extracted those, sorry, and put them here. These are corrections that have to be made because otherwise the clauses, paragraphs just don't make sense. And I must say in this regard I'm pleased that the legal advisors are here because I think this committee is not intended to spend its time editing documents, which is what these 15 errors amount to. This committee is too sophisticated to be expected to have a red pen, and this is exactly why we have legal advisors who should only submit to a committee of this stature a final document that they have proofread. I have this document if it'll facilitate it, but I've really just cut and pasted from my written submissions. It's just the typographical errors.
Just briefly comment that yesterday when the Department of Justice made a presentation, they did admit that there were some typographical errors that they will attend to. They are aware of those errors.
Insofar as the only substantive issue that I have with respect to the CURD, as I say, relates to that small category of retired judges. Because although paragraph 2 in the CURD does say, and I quote, judges not on active service are bound by the rules insofar as applicable, it is not always clear from the context when that category are bound and when they're not. And I would submit for clarity that in fact it should be expressly stated when there should not be a discretionary whether or not people are bound by the CURD. The two particular examples I refer to are paragraph 16.4 and notes 16C and D. Since this category of retired judges are relieved of any obligation to perform a judicial function, it is not understood on what basis any appointment of this category can affect the independence of the judiciary or the separation of powers. Neither is it clear what income would be deemed, and I quote, to be incompatible with judicial office, since all activities, including those activities giving rise to such so-called incompatible income, must, in terms of paragraph 16.3, be compatible with judicial office. I therefore have proposed an amendment which I have written out there and I'll read to you, which restricts the appointment of retired judges only to appointments which would affect the status of the judiciary. All other judges are restricted in appointments that affect the other areas. So I have suggested that the amended clause read, a retired judge does not accept any appointment that is likely to affect or be seen to affect the status of the judiciary. All other judges discharged from active service do not accept any appointment that is likely to affect or be seen to affect the independence of the judiciary, or which could undermine the separation of powers or the status of the judiciary, and do not receive any income incompatible with judicial office. As far as notes 16B and 16C are concerned, the Centre likewise submits that retired judges should be excluded, since the legal justification is to avoid compromising the individual independence of the judge, specifically the perception of independence, and ipso facto, the right of a person to a fair trial. The blanket constraint on retired judges as that tight-knit definition is not understood. In addition, the rationale for differentiating between public and private companies is not either understood. It's only public companies that are listed. If you're going to be influenced, then whether it's a public or a private company, there's no legal or rational justification. Given that retired judges will no longer perform any judicial functions, I submit that the independence, specifically the perceived independence, sought to be protected should relate only to their past judicial functions. I therefore propose that that constraint be limited to public and private companies, both public and private, professional partnerships, and body corporates linked to or in respect of which the retired judge has adjudicated. And those are the only submissions that we have in respect of the Code of Conduct, Mr. Chairperson.
Thank you very much. I was going through your written submission. Will I be correct if I say, in brief, the Centre supports the Code? Because on page 2, I even underlined where it says the Centre supports the Code.
Unequivocally, we absolutely support the notion of the Code. As I said, I think it's imperative to bring long-needed clarity in order to ensure the independence, both the institutional and the individual independence. So we welcome the Code. We're just concerned about those two small substantive areas, and as I said, also the procedural aspects about consensus and not having conflicting provisions between codes and regulations, because that will just lead to confusion again. No, in principle, the Centre is right behind the Code, and all the other provisions the Centre endorses. It's just that small category of retired judges.
Thank you. Before I open to honourable members of Parliament, I just want to ask Mr. Skotana, in my introduction, do you have maybe some comment? I might have left out some of the procedure that led to the agreement that we only deal with the code and hold the regulations in abeyance. If so, I think I can give you an opportunity just to comment on that, which will assist maybe to curtail the proceedings.
Thank you, Chair. I think you covered all the aspects adequately. I would give our own understanding of the code and regulations at a later stage, because in our view, the one is not dependent on the other. The code can still be finalized, be approved by Parliament, and regulations can still be dealt with thereafter. They don't need to go hand in hand because they deal with separate aspects entirely. But we'll give our views on that later.
Thank you, Mr. Skotana. Honourable members, it's now your opportunity. Are there any questions or comments on the submission? I've noted Mr. Gorenov, Honourable Smart. In that order, Honourable Gorenov, the FS.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to, I see that in terms of your remarks, you are silent on note 16A, where they say retired judges may take a private brief to be an arbitrator. I would like to hear your comments on that, whether you think that is appropriate. I'm asking that because there was a recent, a few years ago, a judgment by Judge Ngwenya and Jali, where they criticized a judge where he took a private brief as an arbitrator. He was on review, and it was a successful review. They were of the opinion that he's taking a lesser office when he is migrating to an arbitration office, and that he can be reviewed now by his peers, and they don't think that was appropriate. Further, they say when a quasi-judicial matter is taken on review, it's normally done by a single judge. In this instance, the judge president had to appoint two judges because the judge was the respondent was a retired judge. Now the question arises, and Judge Ngwenya quite correctly say for instance two judges take a joint arbitration, how many judges must the judge president now appoint for review? And you know, arbitration is becoming very fashionable, and it may burden the judiciary, you know, in quite a way if you look at that. So I would really like your comments whether you think it is wise for retired judges to act as arbitrators.
Mr. Chair, would you like me to answer that or wait for
all the questions? You can note them, and then at the end you will get an opportunity of responding to them. Thank you. Honourable Smart. Honourable Smart. You are on the wrong microphone. Thank you.
On the point of substance, thank you to Advocate de Havilland. I think it's something we will take on board and discuss when we deliberate on the code. What I want to do ask now about, sir, and not necessarily Advocate de Havilland, perhaps the persons who should answer are yourself and Mr. Skosana and Advocate Rudman. This is now a difficulty. It is our job here to approve the code with or without our amendments. But as Advocate de Havilland correctly says, if it is the case that there was a difference of opinion between the judges and the ministry, we were supposed to receive two documents. This is the first I have heard of any kind of difference of opinion. And Advocate de Havilland is perhaps privy to some sort of information which is not in the public domain, but this places us now in a slightly difficult position. Can she tell us more about the information that leads her to believe that in fact this is not exactly the way the judges wanted it? Because if that is the case, I want to know what our Chief Justice did want. On the other hand, is one not to assume that their silence is assent, because this has come to us through all the proper channels as a document enjoying their sign-off or the blessing of both the judicial branch and the executive in the form of the ministry and department. So this creates a slight difficulty which I think, sir, we must just resolve, and perhaps you wish to speak to it or the representatives of the ministry and department. If there was a difference of opinion, we were supposed to see both documents. Is it, however, the case that whatever differences there were in fact resolved? The first question is whether the judges are happy with what we have before us.
Responses to the questions, to the two honourable members' questions.
Mr. Co-Chairpersons, I'll deal with the last question first. Insofar as any difference is concerned, my understanding was that in fact when both the regulations and the code were to be discussed, retired judges, I think it was Friedman and Nugent, were going to address this committee because they were privy to, and I speak under correction, but I think also draftsmen of a memorandum, and when they were told
And it was in that context that I was told that they were going to be speaking to this committee because there are differences. I have not had sight of the document. I don't know what the differences are. They may well have been, consensus may well have been reached. All I'm trying to do is alert this committee to the fact that as of last week, there was apparently a code endorsed by the Chief Justice which differed from the documents before us now. More than that, I can't give details. And I would think that this committee is entitled to ask directly of the minister if there's any difference between, in view of the obligation to have sight of any document where there's a difference. And if he says there isn't, then it means that they've resolved it, which is all you need clarity on. Insofar, Honourable Mr. Kuhnhoff, the question of arbitrators, the Centre does support the notion of arbitrators. I think they're an invaluable source. They can, contrary to the isolated cases of review, because my understanding is normally when parties agree to arbitration, they agree to arbitration being the final adjudicator. It's a very common term. So I think the isolated instances will be where you're going to have judges adjudicating on a retired judge's arbitration. They can unclog the horrendous backlog in our courts. They can particularly, in complex matters, where often the judge president in his discretion is obliged to use more than one judge because of the lack of experience in a particular area, has to have a full bench. Retired judges with that plethora of experience can adjudicate on really complex matters, commercial matters, and expeditiously. So we do support the notion of using retired judges as arbitrators. I don't think that it can be any talk of them taking a step down in appointment, because it is that category that has been relieved of all duties. So they don't hold a position as a judge and now they're going down as an arbitrator. The only area where that might arise is when you're talking about the category of judges who have been dismissed from active service but still have to make themselves available for that 3-year window period. And those judges have to apply for permission in terms of the code to be able to adjudicate.
In other words, you are of the opinion that despite the fact that when the judge resigns, he's a senior judge, and then if he takes arbitration and that arbitration is taken on review, it's not sort of like he has taken a lesser job than when he was a judge. His own decision is being reviewed when it is challenged, and a different conclusion or decision may be reached after it is reviewed. Now, if I understand Honourable Kuhnhoff, there is a feeling that it may be causing some, I would say, embarrassment, for the lack of a better way, to say his own peers are now reviewing him, who was the senior to them, something like to that effect.
Honourable Chair, I don't think the issue of review...
Chairperson, can I just add to that? I just want to add, you know, when an arbitration, you know, must become sort of a decision, I just want to see what Judge Nguyen was saying. An arbitrator's award may be subject of judicial review. A judge's decision per se is not subject to review. In order to be enforceable, an arbitrator's award must first be made an order of the court. And when a judge, active or retired, avails himself of a private brief or to arbitrate, he or she dissents in the arena of a lesser than his office. Now, I want to ask, is it then not appropriate to say a retired judge can sit as an arbitrator, providing that there is a clause between the two parties that this matter will not go on review and it's final? But, you know, if it's open-ended, if that clause is not in agreement between the two parties, obviously this becomes a problem.
Uh, The issue of curtailing the review ability of an arbitration by a retired judge, I think that may well be a compromise. But the question as to whether the fact that your decision is being reviewed, judges throughout their lives subject their intellectual application of the law to the facts to their peers, often being forced to comment and disagree in terms of an appeal process. That doesn't necessarily demean or bring them down. That is the healthy process of our judicial system. Advocate Hoffman's also just pointed out that you could also take a review of an arbitration as another alternative to be debated. A review of an arbitration by a retired judge on appeal to other arbitrators, in other words, to retired judges or whatever the case may be. So there are nuanced ways of dealing with that, with the issue of review.
Thank you. Thank you very much. At this juncture, I will hand over to my co-chairperson. I don't want to use the word the lower house now hands to the upper house to continue.
Thank you very much. I won't be wasting your time, but I'll then call upon the institute on Mr. Paul Hoffman. I've gone through your written submission, and I think it is important for us to stick to the code only. Because I've noted that you are referring to Judge Slope and some other issues, and I don't think this meeting is set for that, you know. And let us focus on the code only. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the opportunity to address the committee. Rick, dealing with your point. The reason why a code of conduct has been formulated, the reason why we are meeting here today to make sure that the code of conduct works, is that the mischief to be addressed is misconduct of judges. And the grey areas relating to misconduct of judges can best be sorted out if there is a comprehensive and well thought out code that binds judges so that we do not find ourselves in situations where misconduct of judges is a hot potato, a source of embarrassment, a blot on the landscape. And the reason why the summary of the initial disciplinary proceedings against Judge President Schlope has been made available to this committee is that it affords a good opportunity to the committee of seeing what kinds of mischief judges get up to. You must remember we are not dealing with a criminal code here, dealing with common criminals or persons who cannot conduct themselves properly. All of our judges today have gone through the rigorous selection procedures of the Judicial Service Commission. All of them have persuaded the members of the Judicial Service Commission and indeed the President that they are fit and proper persons and that it is appropriate to appoint them because of their suitable qualifications to be judges. Judges fulfill a very vital role in any constitutional democracy, and in particular in our constitutional democracy, because in the final analysis, the Constitution means what the judges say it means. So if there's ever a dispute about the constitutionality of conduct or of any law that is passed either in this Parliament or at provincial or local level, the final arbiters of the constitutionality of the validity of that law are judges. So it is important that we should put together a code that makes certain that judges are under no misapprehensions as to what they can and can't do in the course of their business. And that summary that I know relates to the regulations more than it relates to the code of conduct, it affords the members of this committee the opportunity in a few pages of seeing the record of over 500 pages of the initial disciplinary proceedings against Judge Schlaupe. As we all know, the DA and Freedom Under Law are involved in litigation about the dispute between the judges of the Constitutional Court and Judge Schlaupe. That aspect is still sub judice in the sense that there is no final determination regarding his visits to the judges of the Constitutional Court in early 2008. And this Parliament is probably well advised to let the judicial process run its course rather than become embroiled in it. But if we are going to deal with a code of conduct now, then the onerous duty on the members of this committee is to make sure that it is clear, that it is concise, and that it leaves no grey areas for these clever people who are judges, who have persuaded those who appoint and select them that they are fit and proper persons, and cannot, if they become rogue judges, find a way around the content of the code of conduct. The code of conduct is a document that needs to be watertight in every way. So this committee has a very serious and onerous task in getting to a final product. In relation to what the final product is going to be, I hear from my learned friend, Advocate de Havilland, that there seems to be some ambiguity as to whether the code that has been put before this committee is the minister's version of the code, or whether it is the product of consensus between the Chief Justice and the minister. And the Act makes it very clear that if there is not consensus, then the Chief Justice's version and the minister's version is put here for this committee to take a decision as to which of the two it is going to prefer in making the final code. So I cannot throw any light on that because I am not privy to the discussions and debates between the minister and the Chief Justice, but it is something on which, and I agree with the Honourable Smuts in this regard, it is something on which clarity needs to be gained, because without clarity you may find yourself in a situation where the code that is adopted by this committee or approved by this committee is then challenged by the judiciary because the requirement that both versions be put before the committee has not been met. That is a technical procedural aspect which I was not aware of before I got here today. I worked on the basis that what has been put before Parliament has been put before Parliament or before this committee of Parliament as a consequence of the consensus that has emerged between the Chief Justice and the Minister. Remember, the Chief Justice is the head of a branch of government called the Judiciary. The Minister is in the Executive, and here we all are in the Legislature, separate from them, and really acting as tiebreakers if they are not in agreement with each other. Sorry.
Chairperson, I hesitate to interrupt someone who's come from the public to give a submission, but is there a concrete point about the code on the table that the advocate wishes to make? We do not need instruction on the separation of the powers and the functions of the separate branches. We do not need remarks on the reasons why the code of conduct exists. We understand the JSC Act and the JSC Amendment Act came through the Justice Committee. We understand better than anyone why it exists. We do not need a description of misconduct by judges. I believe with the Chief Justice that public confidence in the judiciary is the only weapon of the judicial branch, and I do not think it is appropriate everywhere and anywhere to cite cases of misconduct. I particularly do not like my party being cited in this context. So the question is there a crisp comment on any particular provision of the code that the advocate wishes to make?
In the beginning, I've indicated that, you know, we are here because of the code. Can we stick to that particular point? Because I don't want us to deal with something else outside the code, you see. And I hope you will directly go to the point.
I'm very happy to.
Sorry, yes.
Thank you, Chair. I just find it very difficult to accept that the Constitution means what the judges say, because in any case, in any one case, you can have two judges having different conclusions on the matter. Thank you.
Let us proceed.
Yes, I'm happy to proceed to matters of substance. I have no control over what the Honourable Smuts's party does and doesn't do.
Sorry. Can we speak to the points?
Yes.
Let's leave out all this other, because you see, if we proceed that way, we might cut you short.
Can we go to point number 9 in the submission, which is the only point of substance in the written submission? The others are all drafting suggestions or editing of errors, and I understand that the department is doing attending to those. Unless there are any of those that require submissions, I'm not going to waste the committee's time on it. The only point in the written submission that is of substance relates to note 10B. Note 10B on page 11 relates to formal deliberations among judges and their confidentiality. The suggestion of the Institute for Accountability is that the note does not go far enough and that the following words should be added at the end of the note. The note itself, as it reads at the moment, says formal deliberations among judges are and must remain confidential. Private consultation and debate are inherent in the functioning of a judge, and often a mere sounding board is helpful. Confidentiality is also essential for this benefit of collegiality to function. But such occasions may not be used to influence a judge as to how a particular case should be decided. Now, that note is dealing four square with the issues in the pending dispute between the judges of the Constitutional Court and Mr. Justice Schlope. And the suggestion of the Institute for Accountability is that that note would serve justice better and modulate the conduct of judges better if the following words were added at the end of the sentence there. Nor should any judge not seized of a case initiate discussions with or volunteer any unsolicited views on the issues in the case to the judge or judges who are seized of it. Our submission is that that is an improvement to the substance of the code, that this committee ought to have no difficulty adopting. The other matters of substance, which are not in the written submission but which have arisen in the debate this morning and also in the presentation by the department yesterday, are two questions. The first relates to membership of political parties by judges. Now, in that regard, there is no comment from the Institute for Accountability because the Institute for Accountability accepts the drafting of the code, which is that judges should not be members of political parties. That ought to be the position, because if it is not, any judge who is a member of a political party, which is a governing party, may be in a position in which he has to recuse himself in cases that come before him, in which the governing party's interests or the government of that governing party is a litigant. And that would mean more inefficiency, more clogged roles, because matters are perpetually being passed around to judges who are not members of a political party by judges who are members of a political party. It will mean that judges who do not align themselves politically will find themselves in cases with a political flavor. And I think Mr. Skazana made the point yesterday that more and more cases are of that nature. So it is actually unfair to judges who choose not to be members of a political party that they should be on a bench with judges who are members of a political party and are therefore obliged to recuse themselves. Because remember, the test for recusal is whether there is a reasonable perception of bias. Not whether there is bias, but whether there is a reasonable perception of bias. And if one of the two litigants, two or more litigants in a case, is or is related to the party to which a judge belongs, then that judge is in honor bound to recuse himself and thereby place a greater onus, a greater workload on those judges who are not politically aligned. The issue of recusal on a blanket basis is one that will not serve the proper administration of justice, and it is appropriate, if one has regard to the provisions of section 165 of the Constitution, which make it very clear that judges are meant to be independent, and certainly independent of a political party would be included in that kind of independence. They are meant to be in a position to act impartially, which you cannot do if you've aligned yourself with a particular political party, and they are meant to be in a position to act without fear, favour or prejudice. They cannot do that if they remain members of a political party, and one hopes that when President Zuma, in his 8th of January speech, spoke about cadre deployment in all centres of power. I can remind you, because I'm sure a lot of you remember, but maybe not all. In the course of the 8th of January speech this year, President Zuma said, "We reiterate what we said in our 2007 strategy and tactics document, that we place a high premium on the involvement of our cadres in all centres of power. ANC cadres have a responsibility to promote progressive traditions within the intellectual community, which includes our universities and the media. We also need their presence and involvement in key strategic positions in the state as well as the private sector, and will continue strategic deployments in this regard." One hopes that when he talks about all centers of power, he's obviously not talking about the judiciary. And that cadre deployment in all centers of power there is understood to mean not the judiciary. Certainly, if the code of conduct is that there can be no political party membership by judges, then this policy of the ANC relating to cadre deployment would be trumped. In any event, cadre deployment within the public administration, within the public enterprises, and in organs of state is illegal. It's against the Constitution. It's against Section 195 of the Constitution to deploy cadres in those sorts of institutions. Obviously, cadres can be deployed in political positions.
Yeah. I think you've made your point in as far as this particular issue is concerned.
The only, yeah.
Can we move on, because you know you've been, you know, moving in circles around one specific point.
That's it.
And we're not moving forward.
I'm done with that point, thank you. The only other point that I wish to address at this stage, and I'm obviously happy to deal with any queries that the committee may have, is the point raised by the Honourable Kurnoff in relation to arbitration. And I agree with the Honourable Kurnoff that the medicine in relation to retired judges acting as arbitrators has to be that either the parties agree that the finding of the retired judge is final and binding and not subject to review, or that if any of the parties to the arbitration are dissatisfied with the retired judge's finding, it be sent to an appeal panel of arbitrators for final determination by them. In other words, if the arbitration process is one which cannot be referred back to the courts for review, then the difficulties expressed in the judgment to which the Honourable Member refers will be obviated. That is the way around the problem. I can tell the committee from experience that very frequently parties to an arbitration are prepared, because of the confidence they have in the arbitrator, to accept the outcome of his adjudication as final. And in those circumstances, a review will not arise. In the case of retired judges sitting as arbitrators, if the arbitration agreement turns its back on review and resorts to appeal arbitration, where three arbitrators sit to second guess the one retired judge who sat in the original arbitration, then the type of problem and the embarrassing situation of junior judges second guessing a retired senior judge is obviated altogether. There is a way around it, and I think that it is important that this committee regard our retired judges as national treasure. They are experienced people. They are people who have served the public for a long time. 20 years is their normal term of office. And their experience, their knowledge of the law, their ability to adjudicate and to deal with conflict and disputes is something that should not just be tossed in the waste paper basket or disregarded or even hedged about. That perhaps has to do with the regulations rather than the code. There are constitutional questions. The committee has heard those in earlier rounds of this, and it's not relevant to today's discussion. Unless there are any other points on which you wish to hear me, Chair, those are the submissions for the Institute for Accountability in Southern Africa.
No, thank you. I think both inputs, you know, haven't, because you see, we're dealing with the third arm of the state, which is the judiciary. And both the other two arms have codes of conduct, you know. And I'm not sure what is the difference, you know, because it seems in terms of this particular code, there's a slight difference that has been brought in precisely because maybe these are judges that we're dealing with. But we're also, it was also indicated to us yesterday that this particular code, if concluded, you know, will also be taken up towards magistrates, you know. And I'm not sure if, are we going to treat the three arms of the state differently, or will we more or less have the same code for, you know, so that people are treated equally? And that's the point I'm trying to raise, because I've not heard you commenting on both inputs around that particular aspect. But besides that, members, I think the floor is yours. If you have clarities or questions that you need or comments that you want to make, the floor is yours. Can we hear from members?
Chairperson, as to your last point, I think the key lies in the public's confidence in the judiciary. And this was explained to us in the briefing that in putting this code and the register in place, we would be enhancing that confidence. At least that's how I understand it. Just a few issues in Mr. Paul Hoffman's, or Advocate Hoffman's, my apologies, in Advocate Hoffman's submission, Chairperson. In paragraph 1, he says, amongst other things, that there is no prospect of a conflict of interest arising in relation to disclosure of registrable interests of retired judges. One of my colleagues in Parliament, Mr. Ambrosini, always makes the point that we shouldn't use anecdotes when legislating, but unfortunately, in this case, I'm forced to do so. We gave these examples yesterday, Advocate Hoffman, during the committee's deliberations, as examples of how conflict of interest could still arise after a judge has retired. A judge adjudicates in a particular matter, and then post-tenure, the winning party in that matter puts 10,000, 50,000 shares in his name in a particular corporation. Is that acceptable? Of course not. Now, should we not regulate and ensure that that doesn't occur? Good. Now, again, in the same paragraph, Advocate Hoffman says we shouldn't punish judges in their retirement years. Is Advocate Hoffman saying that declaring their registrable interests, in doing that, we are punishing judges? No, we're not. Good. Because he makes the same point again in paragraph 6. We agree with Advocate Hoffman, Chairperson, that retired judges must be regarded as national treasure. But then we mustn't be blinded by that and assume that they are as weak as you and I are, prone to those weaknesses. Because our first concern is the confidence in the judiciary. So,
I'm sorry, member, we need to be slightly careful.
that we are not dealing with the regulations, because the paragraphs you are referring to, his comments are around regulations.
All right. Well, Chair, you see, it makes it very difficult, because now we receive written submissions. And I accept your point. I'm not arguing the point. And extensive submissions. And we told certain things about these regulations. We don't have those regulations before us. It's the first time in my experience in this institution that I'm placed in this awkward situation. But I accept your ruling, and I rest there for now.
Are there any more questions from members?
Advocate Hoffman, just one issue on the question of belonging to a political party. The Bill of Rights, the Constitution, gives everyone the right of association, the right of becoming a member of a political party. If we say judges should not belong to political parties, are we not being unconstitutional by depriving them from using that right? Let me just finalize that. Because we heard from the department yesterday that when they look at other jurisdictions, other countries, they don't bar judges from belonging to political parties. All they do is to say they should not actively participate in political activity. As South Africa, it sounds as if we are going a step further, and as a matter of fact, we are depriving a person who is a judge not to exercise one of the rights that are
thanks. If I can deal with the last point first, section 165(2) of the Constitution says that the courts are independent and subject only to the Constitution and the law, which they must apply impartially and without fear, favour or prejudice. So that is the basis upon which a judge accepts appointment to the judiciary. He accepts appointment on the basis that he has to behave impartially. That is the rule, that is the supreme law in South Africa. Yes, everybody is entitled to freedom of association, but all of the rights in the Bill of Rights can be limited in ways that are reasonable and justifiable in our democracy. The limitation which the code suggests and which we support is that judges should not be members of political parties. That does not mean they cannot vote. It does not mean that they cannot exercise their civic rights. But it does mean that membership of a political party is one step too far away from the necessary impartiality which is set out in section 165(2). So the rights, if somebody wants to be a judge, he must know before he becomes a judge, once the code is in, that his rights to be a member of a political party or a secret organization are taken away from him, because we prize the impartiality of our courts, and we recognize that our judges are answerable only to the law and the Constitution, not to any particular political party at any particular time. As far as the Honorable Landers' points are concerned, I think they all relate to the regulations. So unless you want me to respond to them, I'm not going to.
No, I don't think you need to respond. I think it is important, you know, because I'm taking your point, Honourable Member, because some of us only received this code yesterday, which is a problem. The regulations have been tabled to Parliament. I don't understand why members don't have copies of the regulations, you see, if they are tabled. You see. No, respond later. And I think we have to deal with this particular matter, because I don't think it is correct for us to deal with such important matters and only receive them a day before whatever reason. That is the first area. It seems we only had two submissions. There are no further questions. What I will do now is to hand over to my colleague to summarize and conclude this meeting. Thank you.
Honorable Landers, it seems we are surprised that only two presentations, when we had some NGOs from the various... Ms. Kebo? Oh, he didn't ask to appear before us. Bonani, maybe just to respond for record purpose on the question of us, or some of us, because I received mine last year, and then just explain why other members only received them a day before you.
No,
Mr. Hoffman, if you can switch off the phone, thank you.
I think at the moment maybe I'm only aware of two members maybe who didn't receive. The first one would be the chairperson, because he wasn't here when we had our first meeting. I think even Honorable Nandas was not here when we had our first meeting. But as for the other members, I think all of them have the documents.
Maybe around the regulations? Both of them. Because I had my colleague indicating
and perhaps
that.
You should just reiterate that a different situation pertains to the regulations in view of the meeting that's going to take place between the Minister and the Judge on 13 February, amendments to come. The regulations are anyway not now under discussion.
Okay. Yeah, let me say, when we met for the first time last year, there were some members who didn't make it to the meeting when it was... when the ad hoc committee was established and the like, yes. And then I think, if I recall, we had only two meetings. The first meeting didn't materialize. Only the second meeting materialized, where the chairperson was. The chairperson was appointed. And then because it has been agreed that the regulations are kept in abeyance, I think I would have to just check, because they've been tabled. There will be a need that they are formally withdrawn, or they are kept in abeyance until time is ripe for us to deal with the regulations. And Department of Justice, there were some issues which were said, whether is this the only code that is before us, or there was another code which was drafted and not presented. Because the law requires that if there's some different codes, one from the judiciary, another from the minister, then both should be submitted. Maybe if I can hear you on that aspect.
Thank you, Chair. I did indicate yesterday that the minister was happy with the code from the principal aspects, and he was happy to be guided by Parliament. I'm not aware of another set of code. This code that is before Parliament today was drafted by the Chief Justice and the heads of courts, and was consulted amongst the judiciary. There was a judges' conference in 2009 July, where they met and discussed the principles which were brought, and established a team that drafted the code, and they discussed among themselves, and they gave us the code. And there were discussions between the minister and the Chief Justice in terms of some principles, whatever, but this is a consensus outcome of that meeting. Therefore, from our side, no other code that needs to be tabled by the minister.
Just on this aspect, he would appear, they interpret the act as saying the person who must draft is the minister and not the judge. On the code. Okay, I will draw this latter one. Okay, Honourable Smart.
Yes, I wanted to further, of course, I accept Mr. Sukarno's relation to Muslims. We don't know who that is. If I understand Advocate de Havilland correctly, such dissent or unhappiness that he's aware of or reservations would concern precisely 16.4, the thing that she raises as substance. Is that right? It's only logical that if we haven't finally concluded how retired as supposed to discharged judges should be dealt with, and that is the reason why we're going to review the regulations, to the degree that retired / discharged judges also surface in the code, it would then of course make sense, as she argues, not to conclude the code until we have in fact concluded the Amendment Act, the amendments and the regulations. If we do that, if we then slightly postpone the conclusion of the code until we've dealt with the regulations also, we are then also satisfied that all possible reservations have been ventilated, because the process then goes on a little bit. In a way, one is reluctant not to conclude the code, because the code is the standard against which judicial conduct, becoming and unbecoming, is to be judged, and the JSC needs to proceed with such complaints as it has. So in a sense, one wants the code now to be concluded. It is now, 7 months since the law came into operation. But I think it is clear that the matter of the retired and discharged judges is also the same issue that arises under the regulations. It's also the one problem area of the code. And therefore it does make absolute sense, as Advocate de Havilland argues, that we don't conclude the code until we have decided what must happen with the retired judges. Is that not so?
Mr. Chairperson, as far as the content of what may have differed, I have no privy to what that was. I was just told that there are differences. They may well be small. I'm very relieved to hear from the department that this is in fact the code as approved by the Chief Justice, which was based on a memorandum drawn up by a subcommittee of the heads of court, where there is some complete consensus from the judiciary, because it is only the code that calls for consensus. It's only in respect of the code that there must be consensus. So I think that whole hornet's nest that I was a bit scared that I'd opened up about, there might be other versions floating around. If this is the version as approved by the CJ, then I think it can be accepted that the undertaking from the department that the minister is happy with it. In other words, he doesn't have. Because now it would appear that the only other difference would emanate from the minister, because this is the code drafted by the CJ. My concern, yes, Honourable Smuts, is that because the question of retired judges does emerge in both documents, and you cannot have conflicting views. For instance, we say in the code, retired judges mustn't belong to a political party, but we also restrict what retired judges can do in terms of work. If that aspect conflicts with whatever the regulations are eventually going to say, you are again going to bring in confusion. Unless at that stage it is argued that the regulations must complement the code. But that doesn't appear to be a legal basis, since the two authors are different, and the Act does give the Minister a free hand in that he only has to consult with the CJ on the regulations. So one doesn't trump the other, and you would have a conflicting situation.
No, I don't share. Yeah, but I think because the same regulations must come through this committee and parliament, you know. Now it is upon this parliament to take a final decision. I don't think there will be, because Parliament will have to make sure that the regulations complement the code, and that should be the situation.
Mr. J.P. Scotland. Yeah, I was calling him Mr. J.P. Scotland.
let me give some just few highlights which may assist the discussion. The code is intended solely to regulate conduct, not to make law. The law is very clear in relation to aspects which have been raised as part of the submission. Whether a retired judge can be a private arbitrator or whether can perform any functions is in the law, is in the act. And the act is very clear. It says a judge discharged out of service can perform any other function for reward if consent by the minister and consultation with the chief justice has been given. And the act goes on to give the minister clear guidelines which functions may be performed by such judges. So that would not basically be regulated by the code. The code only relates to how people should conduct themselves at the end of the day. Now, when you read the act makes a distinction between acting and judge out of active service only in relation to regulations. In relation to the code applies to all the same because it's how they should behave. In fact, the code even applies to acting judges. It applies to judges out of active service because it's how they should behave, how they should conduct themselves, how they should give judgment, whether they should treat people with courteous dignity, whatever. So those aspects apply to all judges. The distinction that has been brought here in terms of the movement, whatever I said yesterday, that they are just an emphasis. But in the code, even if they are there, they are dealt with by legislation. So I would hope that the honorable members would basically find that distinction when they go through the regulation, the act, etc. Hence, I said earlier on that the finalization of the code is not dependent on regulation. The finalization of the code is the conduct, etc. And from our side, we have also said that the sooner they are finalized, the better the access to justice are enhanced in terms of people, in terms of complaints, in terms of everything. Regulations deals with the declaration of interest, and that's why it's important to distinguish between aspects relating to acting, discharge, and judging in active service, etc. But we can provide further info on these aspects in a response form to assist Parliament. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think, honourable members and everyone, we should accept it that this sort of it encounters that the judges are going to be accountable, but it doesn't touches on their independence, the independence of the judiciary being only subject to the constitution and the like. Their conduct, is it the conduct or the misconduct, etc. And if the judge has misconducted himself or herself, there should be mechanisms for the community to lay that complaint against the judge. Let me take this opportunity to thank everyone for your attendance here, and we will keep the ad hoc committee informed about further developments as to what needs to happen. Thank you very much. Thank you for your time.